Yeah, let's keep this on. One never know. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the H.B. Tom Theatre, and more specifically, the Woordfeest 2016. Just a brief introduction from the Woordfeest side. Joyce Kotze grew up in Namibia, studied in Cape Town, and worked as a radiographer on the conflict-torn borders of Southern Africa. Her interest in war and its effects on the lives of those caught up in it stems from a family history. Her grandfathers found themselves on opposing sides in the Boer War. Her great uncles fought in the Great War, and her father in World War II. She divides her time between Namibia and Riebeek Valley near Cape Town. She continues writing. Jonathan Amit is a freelance proofreader, editor, and manuscript advisor. Writes regular reviews for Litnet, Slipnet, and the Cape Times, and is a part-time lecturer at the English Department of the University of Stellenbosch. Welcome to both of you.
Skalk, just before we start, okay, the mic's on. Okay, fantastic. You've made it. Excellent. We're just about 5 minutes late, but I don't think anyone will mind. Good morning, Joyce. We've barely had a chance to...
Good morning. How are you?
...to become acquainted. I'm very well. How are you doing this morning?
Always well, thank you.
All the way from Riebeek Wes. I'm very pleased to have you here. To start off with, maybe just a show of hands to see who's read Joyce's book so far. Okay. So we have a faithful legion of fans here this morning, about 15 diehards, mostly women. So you'll have to make a plan to get the men on board.
I do have some men aboard. The most recent one is from Denmark.
I see. Excellent. Well, I'd like to start off with an appraisal and a compliment for you. I read this book, and I'm a voracious reader, but I read it in one sitting, and I decided to do that because from the first page of this wonderful story, I was drawn in, and without being superfluous in praise, it's a really wonderful novel. It's beautifully written. It's exceptionally moving. It takes you to so many different places while you're reading it, and it has a real tactile quality. You really sense everything that happens in the book, from the smallest little details to the grand historical sweep of what you're painting with this novel. And I feel that it's a novel that really carries its momentum all the way through. You know, with a book that's 570 pages, you might experience a dip at some point. But you managed to avoid any kind of pitfalls, and by the end, you're actually wanting more. So I'd like to really give you all the praise for this wonderful novel. As a way to start, you have a very intimate connection with war, I would say.
Yes, I sort of grew up with all the stories in the war, because my grandfathers were on opposite sides, because we were from Irish and from German and Dutch stock. So my Oma, she used to tell us how very kind the English were to them while they were on the veld. She was only 14 years old when the Boer War happened, and how the English actually helped them, you know, gave them food and all that. So I thought, well, the English aren't all that bad. And on the other side, Auntie Joyce, who is now 90, and, you know, the rest of the Dixon family, they always said that the Boers were absolutely stupid to take on the mighty British Empire, and it's their fault. You know, so it was from both sides. And then the next generation went into the First World War, and most of them got killed, couldn't even find the bits of them, not even their names, three of them. And then the next one went, 19-year-old, in the Second World War, and then I went into a war, and... War will always be with us, so you might just as well go through yours and live through it. But it's the individuals in war. That's what my father taught me. Although he fought against the Germans and, you know, in Italy, North Africa, and got wounded very badly, never had anything bad to say about the ordinary German soldier. That's why in what I'm writing and what I'm writing now and in there, I try to take both sides and see the emotional impact on the individuals from both sides. Because it's individuals who fight wars, not governments. You know what I mean? The individuals got to go there and actually do the killing and the suffering and swearing and all that stuff.
So when did you decide to write this book? And I mean, it's not a small undertaking to cover a portion of history that, I mean, let's be frank, everyone should know what happened in the war. But you managed to present it in a way that is fresh and that's new and that makes one think about the kind of climate that we have now, where there's a general feeling of uncertainty, mistrust, people choosing sides, you know, people feeling very uncertain, and the way that you then sort of little by little build up the sense of an anticipation until the war eventually erupt. So where did you start? What was the seed for your novel?
I was going to say, you can put this story in any war, in any, you can put it now. It's always been
It
like
has
that.
Such a universal quality.
It has, yeah. I never asked Ria, now she was at school with me, I never said I'm going to be a writer one day. It just happened. One day I didn't sit down and write the book. I sat down and wrote the story, which happened to turn into a book, but I was halfway through the story when I went to Europe and I asked my Oma, where shall I go and look for your three brothers? You know, their graves. And she said, but they have no graves. So I couldn't believe it. So I found them on the missing for the, in the Somme, you know. Anyway, then I started taking interest in the First World War and left that aside. And then through the years, I carried on with both of them and the third one. And with Sharon Taub, she's my editor, we got that one down to half the size that it was.
This one?
Yes.
So you had more than 1,000 pages worth
yes,
of worth of writing.
Yes, thicker than Gone with the Wind, my mother-in-law said. So I wrote, and I wrote. And I thought, if I kill this one off now, I won't have enough pages, you know, to fill up. So I don't kill him off, I just make him wounded. I'm just only joking. But no, it was actually much thicker than that.
Okay.
And then you get the editors, and they cut out all the crap and the author's indulgence, you know, that bits where you... Because what I do, why you find that, and I have that comment from many people, unputdownable, to me, such a word.
It is a bit of a cliche, yeah.
Yeah. At every page, got to move the story on. Mm. Otherwise, delete.
Yes.
So what I'm doing now, I am... This next book, it's coming out March next year, because that's been translated first. So this will be out for Christmas.
Okay, excellent. I want to ask you about the translation in a moment.
And then, so I've got 320,000 words, which I've got to reduce to, it's lovely, I love rewriting. I've got to reduce it to, say, 200. That's about 220.
Okay. So you've got to cut about 100,000 words.
Yes.
Why, though?
Because when you sit down and you get carried away, you know, you just do what these people say, you know, characters.
But aren't people enjoying big books again?
Yes, I know.
To get sidetracked.
Mm-hmm. But of course, that's my first one. They weren't going to give out a thick, okay, first, you know, an unknown author.
Yeah.
But I had an excellent editor,
okay,
Alfred Lemaitre.
Well, editors, I think, are as important as writers.
They are absolutely essential. I don't think I can do without an editor, because I tend to carry on. But now I've learned to, you know, leave the other bits out. That's not really important.
Okay.
That doesn't move the story on. Don't move the story on.
Okay. So, you've spoken about your interest in finding the graves of your family members. I want to ask you a specific question about characters in this book. Before I get to the different perspectives that you take.
Did you like the characters?
I love the characters.
Why
and
did you like them?
They're all sympathetic. That is the wonderful thing about a novel like this, when you can write and have a massive, massive cast of characters, but they're all credible, they're all believable, and they all have a story to tell. They're not just functional to move the story along. So I'd like to ask you about the family story and the two sides, which is obviously it's an excellent narrative device, because you've got the Boer side and then you've got the side of the Brits.
Cousins, yeah.
How did that come about? Why did you decide to bring in the cousins in the story? Cousins may be working better than a brother or a sister.
Yeah, no, you couldn't. The brother was just too close. Mm. Because, as I say, we are Irish and Dutch and a little bit of German as well. That's how my genetic pool works. And the Dixon side were always sort of opposing the other side. That was before I was born, because they were pro, but then they were cousins as well, like Uncle Roy, Jimmy Dixon, you know him, and those people, they were cousins of my father, you know, and great aunts, great uncles and great aunts. So that's where I thought, well, let's just take the cousins, you know, and push them off to England and, you know, let them stew there and see what happens. So that's what happened.
And how do you avoid, if you know your family members so well, how do you avoid writing the people you know into the characters too much?
I don't think I did that.
No, I don't think you I don't think you did at all.
Because I'll be by this stage if any of my sisters find themselves in there or husbands.
Namibians are hardcore.
I think I've been asked many times, is there any character in this book that took something out of me, Joyce? And there is one. But the others are bits here, you know, people that I've met in the Air Force when I was on the border war. And yes, and then I just put them on a page and then they just do what, you know, they form themselves. I create them and they just live through it. And sometimes I've got to stop them, you know, sort of. It sounds like I'm dilly, but I am a bit dilly. But,
well, well, characters have their own life, you know.
They do.
They take a life of their own.
They do. I woke up one night and there was this Jan Viljoen character saying, the English says, you know, the English says, you saw my God, you parkrip, you know. And I woke up and I thought, yeah, okay, fine. I'll quickly go and put that bit in. You know, that's how it works. And then I returned to normal again in the morning.
Well, all a little schizophrenic, you know, if you can channel it into a book, all the better. What I really enjoyed was the fact that you managed to find a balance between, say, three different genres. Obviously, it's a historical novel, first of all, but there's a family saga at the core. Mm-hmm. There's a romantic element. There's a lot of sex in this book, by the way. Quite a passionate...
There was no time for romance. It was war. It was just passion. Give it, you know.
Well, there's a lot of passion, right?
No red
there
roses
is a lot.
And candles,
No. People were very honest about their intentions. So you've got the romantic aspect, and then I would say, especially in the last 200 pages, you've got I want to call it almost something like a thriller element, where the momentum of the plot gathers so much, and you have characters in jeopardy and people's lives that are in danger, and that investment that you make throughout the book, that really comes to the fore, and you care so much about these characters, and you're gripped right until the final climax, because there are various high points in the book, but right up until the epilogue, basically you are wondering what will happen with these characters, and it's a delicate balancing act to bring all those elements together.
Yeah, and I think that when you get to the end of a big story like that, things got to go fast. You can't just, you know, you have to move it fast, and then it's not every page getting on with the story, then it's just about every paragraph got to tell you, because you've got to move to a sharp conclusion, but not make it like a cliche, oh, this one meets this one, and... You know, oh, sorry that I've done this and that kind of thing. No, you leave that out, because that's not how people will feel, I think. You know, so maybe I got it right there.
I think you did. Oh. How do you decide what to leave in and what to leave out? All these questions eventually come back to sort of editing and fine-tuning. But, I mean, in a historical novel, you can basically include anything. You can include any train of thought, any conversation, any stolen moment that only two people would know about. Mm. So how do you go and decide when you're building the story what to leave in and what to exclude?
Well, what I did, and with the next one as well, first, you know, a lot of research. I love doing research, and I've been to the battlefields.
Can you tell us a little bit about your research for this book?
For this one?
Yes, for the Runaway Horses.
Right, that's why it's written in English, not in Afrikaans, because most of the research that you do is in English. I couldn't find enough.
That's actually quite surprising, because if you think of a novel on the Boer War, you think of something written in Afrikaans. You don't necessarily think of an English book.
Yeah. So I built the historic line first, and then I start creating characters right in the beginning. And it's usually with a dialogue, when the character speaks his first line, that I sort of see, well, like that little Stephanie on the first page, she's going to be a heart, you know, she's really going to cause trouble further on, you know. And then I build, but I can't include the whole of the Boer War, you know. I just have to follow where the characters go. But I did research for the entire war, and I went to all the places. There's even a pub there that I just mentioned once in Cambridge, where I had a wild night because I just wanted to know what the pub was like, and it ended up me almost falling in the river. But anyway, it was a nice
good research.
Yeah.
Good research.
So I don't know, like with what I'm writing now, I've been to these places. It's set mostly in the Karoo. But then wham, bang, I put you in Delwood, you know, like, you know, very quiet, peaceful, the rebellion and all the passions and things. I call it torrents of spring, that part. And they get all sort of cross with each other, you know. Spring really sort of wakes up the hormones and the blossoms and the trouble. And the rebellion was there.
So you're going all out with the blossoms?
Yeah, the blossoms and the quits and... And then, of course, the war. They had to go after the war, and we'll see.
Well, I don't think in terms of anything dramatic that you can really go wrong with a story that is essentially about war. You have the you have the dramatic kernel of events. Yeah. And what you've done with the book is you've made it very personal. And I think that's the angle that readers will enjoy. That it's not just a historical account, but that everyone that lives in this book, that they matter, and that they matter to other people, and that you can engage with them, and that they mean something.
Yeah, and that life still goes on. I mean, you're 20 or you're 19, and there's this war dumped on you, but you're still a person. I mean, you still fall in love, and you still get cross, and you still have to live. Yeah. And I mean, you're not going to put it aside just because there's a war.
Yes, and I like the fact that you showed that the war isn't responsible for all the heartbreaks in the book. Mm. You know, people actually live their lives, you know, and war is incidental in a sense, and then it separates families and people have to choose sides. Yeah. Yeah. And that to me was beautifully handled.
Thank you.
I really thought that was very well done. In terms of the milieu of the story, you're building a very local picture with the Boers, but you're also showing the reader Victorian England. So how do you manage to represent both equally in a sense and create a sense of contrast, but also show how the two societies had overlaps and similarities? That's a tough one, Anna.
No. When you create, like, the character James Henderson is a cavalry officer, and because my husband was in the Air Force, a pilot in the Air Force, so I met a lot of real English, you know, because chopper pilots in nowadays are the cavalry. So they used to talk like that. And also I've got a lot of English friends, and I've read a lot about Victorian England. So you just stay in that character's point of view. That is the most important thing, to make it a personal. You never go out of the character's point of view. It's whether he's riding a horse, whether he's fleeing, whether he's having when he's in bed with someone, you know, you stay in his point of view. What does he feel? What does he think he's doing? And if, when you're in the British one, you stay in the British one. When you're in the Boer one, you switch over here.
So would you write little bits specifically in terms of characters and scenes? Would you stay with something and then sort of edit it together?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't know how to do it. As I said, I first just wrote a story. I got to York Varsity to see, because I was then on to my third book. Now, how do you actually do it? Because this is just getting thicker and thicker.
Mm-hmm.
To York Varsity. And I thought, no, I'm not going to land in the slush pile. You know, they've got the slush pile of...
I work with a slush pile, so yeah.
But I'm not going in this.
No, especially not a book like this. It's no one's ever going to read it.
So you write it to a toxic, like a farm. You go left after it was bought.
Well, I think, I mean, Jonathan Ball is an excellent publishing house, so you're in very, 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 very safe hands. Every writer is a procrastinator. Every single writer. They're terrible. I love the sound of deadlines as they sort of wish away. They're awful. We do our best. We're not in a war. I want to ask you about place, specifically. I mean, we're in what has been described recently sort of as the ideological birthplace of apartheid. We're in Stellenbosch. We're constantly these days reminded about divisions between people, haves, have-nots, where you can go, where you can't go. What struck me about your sense of setting and place here is the fact that these characters they're formed by their environment, and it's an absolutely essential sense for who they are, to their identities. Can you talk a little bit about your Namibian background and how that influenced the way that you wrote about the place for these characters?
Right. I think if you want to write about the place, whether it's a place in history or whether it's a place where, the soil, the place that you write about, the environment, you've got to know it very intimately. You can't put me in Hungary and say, let's write a novel about Hungary, because I wouldn't know anything about the customs or the way they talk, the way they, So I know Namibia. I went there when I was 10 days old. Can't even remember crossing the border. And I went to school there, and then I went to school in Makwaland, just across the border, and then when I finished studying, I went straight back there. And that's where I spent most of my life. But also I spent some time in South Africa, and because of my South African connections, and my Oma, who was in the Boer War, and the aunt, I got a very solid foundation in South Africans, whether they're English or Afrikaans. But is that the place that you asked about? I don't understand. Okay, and there's a cave in there, and I've been into the cave, so all these things come back. So what I'm writing now, I sit in the Karoo. And it's a marvelous place to write. So I don't use adjectives and adverbs, so you've got to really that to me, it's just overall.
Yeah.
I find all these, you just put to the colors and the things, and you put it in to
Well, I mean, the Karoo is such a unique landscape. It has such a specific kind of beauty.
Yeah. Is that the sense of place, or do you want
No, I wanted to find out a little bit more about your sort of your own background now, sort of growing up in Namibia and then.
And working.
Did you choose that, or did it happen to you?
Or I also want to go. My father was there, so I also want to have a bit of it. But I was not in the military. I must stress that I was on the other side. Being a rebel, I had to choose the other side. I was in contact with my friend, the Vambo people, and I was also married to a military man. So that made it more exciting. So I could play like I always wanted to be a spy. But I wasn't a spy then, I just sort of worked it. And I got into some very tough situations, but that's part of life, isn't it? Something doesn't happen. So it was difficult, It sort of, because you get the patients, the ones that, we could call it patients, the casualties, as they were on the battlefield, bushes, whatever. And, yes.
Well, you're definitely a very strong woman, and this book, although it's a novel about men, and masculinity and war and what it does to men's psyches. You don't neglect women. Can you talk a little bit about the different female characters in the book and how they came to you and sort of why you allowed them to have an integral role to the story? Because they're not just there for a little while and then you ship them off.
No, because they were also in the war. The war was also pushed into their lives.
Yeah.
You see, and you can't just leave it out and have all these men going shooting in the bush and killing each other. You have to have the home element as well, the tante Kubas, the farm.
Yeah.
What the effect of the war was on them.
Yeah.
Because they were also alive then, and it also affected their lives. So I chose, I think, 1 to 3.
Yeah.
Four main characters. Mm. An old aunt, which is the wise one, and then the typical lovely soft boy girl,
yeah.
And then this educated girl, Stephanie, I think, yeah. And I had to have a British girl as well, just to make the love triangle type of thing. And because they were also part of the war. They also went through it, they also suffered through it, they had to live through it. So you have to have this womanly point of view as well. Does it answer your question?
Yes, absolutely.
No,
it definitely does. What struck me while reading the book is that you're reading about Boer characters that are Afrikaans, and you know that they're Afrikaans, but they're speaking in English, and you never actually feel that it's an awkward translation or that you don't buy what the people are saying.
Yeah.
Was that a challenge for you? Because it was never... I didn't read the book and thought, okay, maybe this is an Afrikaans story that's being told in English.
Mm.
It feels... intact, the language feels natural, and it's convincing, it works.
Yeah, Paul Kruger was quite difficult to get him to speak English. I had books and books and books just to his character. You know what I mean by fear?
But you don't turn him into a caricature or a stereotype.
No.
He's actually a real person.
Yeah, a real person. He's just there to draw the history together. As you can see, he's got his point of view in 3 or 4 beginning of the part. So this, he sits on his stoop. And you draw the entire history of what's happened in the last couple of years together in his mind. So to get him to English was not difficult because I knew him then. You see, like he was a as die jong man maar net 'n vrou kan kry. You know, I, you know, and it sort of got through in English sounding Dutch. Isn't that true? Like Kitchener talking, you know, I couldn't have him in Afrikaans. This is, how can he say that in Afrikaans? Good God, you know, you can't say that in Afrikaans. You must stop now, I'm getting sick. But anyway, carry on.
No, but although this is such a serious book, it's so incredibly enjoyable to read. It's a pleasure to read. It draws you in, and although it's serious and although people's lives are at stake, you just turn and turn and turn, and then you're on page 100, and then you're on page 200, and then it's 350, and then you take a pee break, and then you finish the book because you've enjoyed it so much. What was the most enjoyable part of the book? Because, I mean, to make an investment in a book like this, it takes quite a long time to write. What did you enjoy the most about writing?
This one? I absolutely love the Boer characters, you know, and the way they lift their dances, and, you know, Jan Viljoen drinking his homebrew.
There's such an exuberance, you know, from the dancers to the Mampur.
And what you do, like, they're having this dance at the drift on New Year's Eve, and immediately cut to the British dance in England to show the sharp contrast between morals and, you know. And I love doing the dances, and I love doing, you know, the lesser characters like the twins. I love writing about them, and Jan Viljoen and those guys. That was enjoyable. But when I get to the deaths, I didn't decide who's going to live and who's going to die. You just get there, and all of a sudden, you know, the bullets are coming. And I don't believe in a writer who spares his main characters. Because, like, now in the First World War, they're all in the war.
So there's no sequel. There's no Runaway Horses 2.
I'll think about it, but... I can't tell them.
Yeah, and I don't want to give away too much.
Anyway, I'll think about it, but not yet, because I'm too much into what I'm doing now. So.
Well, I can feel that you want to talk about your new book.
Yes.
I can't really talk about it because it's not out yet. It's still being produced.
Rewritten.
So, all good writing is rewriting.
It's called Beyond Forgiveness. It's not a soppy title. It's an angry title. Because what happened in the First World War, not just to South Africans, to the whole entire generation, was absolutely beyond forgiveness.
Do you think enough people know about that part of history?
Well, they have to tell them about it.
I don't think enough young people, definitely.
Exactly.
I don't think they do.
I was one day in Johannesburg, I was asked, well, where are, you know, about that book, where are the Jews then? You know, and Hitler. So I thought, well, okay, let's just not laugh at ignorance. Let's just keep South African history alive in fiction. Because if you give them a history book, so you give them fiction. Yeah. Where were we now? First World War.
First World War.
Like Beyond Forgiveness. What happened there? I think, you know, I'm obsessed by the First World War. I've got to raise the white flag.
Well, I think it's the neglected war for sort of my generation and the one, I mean, everyone knows the Second World War and sort of the Holocaust and from then, but the First World War, not necessarily so much.
Lots of novels are coming out now about the First World War. I had to wait for them to come out because I want to say what they don't say.
Which is
always
what?
The trenches in Passchendaele and the mud and the shell shock and all that.
Yeah.
I have to tell it specifically from a South African point of view. See what I mean? Because they were in a rebellion, fighting against each other, a civil war, which everyone's forgotten about mostly.
Yeah.
And then I've got to twist their minds to go and fight for England, who's just ruined their country. That kind of thing. So it's quite...
But that's an incredible conflict to think about.
So then off they go to France. And what happened, I think, you know, everyone has been to the battlefields there. Let me just give you a quick example. I'll be quick. At the Tifor monument on the Somme, there's this huge, ugly, ugly building where it goes right into the sky. 75,000 names on it of just bodies that's not been found. Because they had to fight over a stretch of mud, say a kilometer long, and they never had time to remove the bodies. So you fight through last year's bodies and the bomb comes and poof, goes the leg, poof, goes, you know.
It's unimaginable.
It's true. I'm telling you, it's true. And then, that's 75,000 names. Then you go to Minengate, where my great uncle's, the one is there, and the other two at Tifo. The 55,000 names of just... They can find a leg, they can find a skull, but they cannot find the name of the person. And I've been back quite often, and they're still, 100 years later, they still find bodies and unexploded bombs and gas things.
Yeah.
And it's true, I'm not lying. Go there.
Well, it's just, I always sort of more and more these days think of what William Faulkner said when he said the past is never dead, you know, it's not even past. And we're reminded of that constantly, you know, especially as South Africans, especially the last, say, 10 years since the Truth Commission, we're trying to work through various kinds of traumas and we're trying to make sense of our history and history is being...
Yeah, because on part it was also a psychological war.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you've got to try and get through that. And whether you protested against it as a student, whether you lived like that, it was a psychological war, I think.
Yeah.
And we all get through it the way we can think, as I say, a character's point of view. That's how we get through it, I think.
Yeah.
The first time I was on TV with this book, unfortunately, was the day that... put some green paint on Paul Kruger's statue.
That is an incredible irony.
So it was in the morning, you know, I'm not wide awake in the morning. I was sitting there, the makeup girl didn't arrive, so I was just sitting there.
And they didn't paint you green that day?
No, sitting there, watching this little, it's like a little eye that you had to watch. And then the guy on the news said, are you responsible for this? And I said, no. So why did your book come out today? I said, you know, it's just sort of coincidence, and I had to explain what would I do About Rose's statue. Once someone in Johannesburg asked me on air about it, because then Rose was painted. So I had to think quickly. So I said, well, you just take the statue, the thing, hide it away until all this is over, because it's rebellion. People's got to rebel. The people's got to rebel. I believe in that. It's rebellion, and it calms down, and, you know, all the anger is spent, and then later on you bring it back and put it back. That's all you can do, isn't it?
Well, you can't destroy history.
No, you can't.
I think that's a lesson that we're learning.
But also, what you just said now, we don't have to remember all these terrible things in history. Like, in the British school work, the Boer War, I'm telling you, it's one paragraph. Just one paragraph. I checked it out the other day. So that's why my book is doing quite well in England, and especially in the Netherlands, because they want to know what actually happened.
Well, it sounds like they actually don't know about it.
No, because they weren't taught. Like, you didn't know about... Do you know anything about Delvalwood?
Very little.
But you know the name?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're a historian, aren't you, Joe?
Yeah.
So very few people know about that. 3,120 something South African soldiers went in on the 15th of July. 5 days later, 122 came out. So I've got to kill off some main characters in there. I can't spare them for the end, you see.
What?
That's why I've got so many characters in the beginning, because, you know, kill
them. it's like choose your own adventure, and kill the one off, then there's a birth, and there's a death, and weddings, and, it's fascinating to me to think that at this point in time, there's, I think, a hunger for stories in this country that is being reinvigorated. I think there's such a lack of consensus about history, about where we are. There's a lot of negativity.
Yes.
But I don't think there's sort of a national narrative where everyone is on the same page.
We're trying to find our way. That's what we're doing. It's now 20 years. We're still trying to find common ground, that's a cliche, but we're trying to form our own history of the whole country, you know, pre-apartheid and now. Yeah. How are we going to go forward with all this? That's why you put history. I'm going to write about a novel, I hope, about apartheid. Mm. But I cannot set it in this country because I didn't live under apartheid. I lived in Namibia. We had very little apartheid.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just one of those free countries still today.
Mm.
So I'm setting it against communism. We can compare the two, can't you? If you are on the other side of apartheid,
you certainly can. Yeah.
So we'll do communism compared with apartheid in the 50s, and then.
So which part would you go? Sort of the height of the Cold War and the end of the apartheid.
Yes, and it's also about suicide and classical music, by the way. Yes, I'll go to Hungary. For that, I've already written it in here. I've been in Hungary when it was just open, and I couldn't believe the emotions in that place. It's like, anyway, that's a fourth book, so.
Well, we have history in South Africa, and then you have history in Namibia, and you have such rich history in the whole of Europe, in countries that we, for instance, I mean, who thinks of Hungary on a daily basis? Mm. But then you have the privilege of visiting in a place, and history is everywhere.
It's everywhere.
And what you feel with this book is that history is not some sort of linear narrative thing, but it's something which happens in the moment, you know, and the characters are in history, and you feel with every decision that they make, they are escalating on some level, they're moving forward, and there's a sense of characters being formed, and I think that is very natural, and I think it's one of the things that you can get with fiction that you won't necessarily get in a historical account, which is more factual.
Yeah.
And I think the sort of the blend between fact and fiction, you've got a lovely shout out on your cover from Tim Cousins.
Yes.
Who's, I mean, he is a wonderful historian, of this blend between fact and fiction.
Yes.
And is it something you sort of strive towards, to have that
a
kind of balance between the two?
You've got to stay true to the historical facts. You have to.
I enjoyed the fact that this was not a metafictional, revisionist sort of intellectualization of history. I mean, it's a trend sort of especially of academics when they write.
Yes.
They write fiction.
And this is written in pure South African English.
Yeah.
You know, you don't stumble over a word and look for a dictionary because I can't use those words. Yeah.
It's beautifully written, but it's not pretentious.
It's not pretentious.
It's not. It's your nose isn't in the
They're
air.
They're laughing about the word that I couldn't say. It's your quast. Shall I say it?
Which one?
No, I had to read one first prize at York Varsity to read something out of the book. And this one word, I know exactly what it means, and I know how to pronounce it in the Namibian way, but I couldn't pronounce it in the English way.
You've got to tell us.
So I sat on the plane and I practiced that, taught me how to say it. Got on the stage, and now Harry Bingham, he's got what I'm going to read in front of him, so I got to that word and I put another word in it.
Iridescent.
Exactly.
Is that the one?
No. It's only once.
It's a lovely word.
Yeah, I know exactly what it means. I know how to spell it, but I just couldn't
can't
get
pronounce
past
it.
The R. Yeah. So I'm not. It's not a literary. You know what I mean? It's not a deep. In the language sense, it's not. It's light, not light to read, easy to read. And that's what I strive for. Keep it easy and flowing.
I think that's one of the biggest achievements for a book to be readable. Mm. Without dumbing it down, without having the characters becoming stereotypes or all speaking in the same language, but for the reader to feel that this writer is talking to me on my level. You know, and I think the connection with the writer is then a lot deeper for the reader, that you can actually... You're engaged a lot more, and you don't feel okay. But I'm not sure what this means. Mm. What is this trying to say? You know.
Why does he do this?
And why?
I know why he does it. You know.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So I think it's an accessible book.
Thank you.
And I think it's a book that could be a prescribed text. I think so. It reads like. The best kind of books, when I was in school about 10 years ago or so, finishing up, it reads like those best books. And
when I was at school, we weren't even allowed a kiss in a book. You know, it was cut out.
Was it redacted?
No. So, yes, it's going to be translated then. She can say it, the publisher. It was just heard yesterday.
Well,
into Afrikaans.
Congratulations is then in order. Who is going to translate this?
Daniel Hugo.
Ha.
Our privilege.
Who will be publishing it? Will it be published by Jonathan Ball?
Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful. So how long? When can we expect this?
He said end of September he will be done.
Well, I think it's going to be a spectacular book in Afrikaans.
How would you translate the title? Come on. Do you know Afrikaans? Give me a title.
I would not go with a literal translation.
No, definitely.
I wouldn't go with a literal translation.
We'll
I would
leave
go
it to Daniel to find one.
Oh, no, Daniel, I shall recht in kry.
But I can see it in Dutch, die wegholperde. You know, it doesn't work. No.
Yeah. Would you read for us?
No, you can read a bit. I read very fast and I stumble over the words and you're going to pick that bit.
I've got a passage on page 230.
Oh, I know what that is. Okay, I'll read it fine. But remember, I speak Namlish and my accent is also very... Right, this is where the title of the book comes from, actually. And I don't know what to do when I got here because it's just before the war started. And I thought, they're all together now, so... What will happen now? And then this Martinus de Winter started talking, warning the young men about the dangers of war. Now they're sitting on a stoop, they had homebrew, and they're looking at the full moon. And the full moon actually did rise on that day, I checked it. So Uncle Martinus is saying, war is a kind of madness, a madness to kill. It comes from a fear, a deep primeval fear of death, and yes, a fear to kill. We all carry this fear within us. There are men who cannot stomach the killing for long. War, sons, wearies the soul. Strong, good men, they break down inside, they make mistakes, they die. Some men get through war with only a wounded body, as they close their minds to suffering and death. Yes, those are the fortunate ones, for the body doesn't hurt as deeply as the soul. Then there are those who fight bravely until they reach the threshold of despair, and it comes to them in their weariness, the futility of this madness. So they give up, they break away. They should have stayed, as everything had a beginning and an end, but their souls are too weary of war to reason. Those are the runaway horses, the ones with the wounded souls. The moon was traveling its course, a jackal called plaintively from the flame. Uncle Martinez, James, broke the silence on the stoop. What happens to them, sir, the runaways? When it's all done, do they come back to the herd? Martinez shook the dottle from his pipe. No, son, they are not accepted.